I was in love with the big, beautiful Palm Island Club, my dad wrote later in his memoir. I was in love with the adjoining 15-room mansion. In short order, my father leased the club for $7,500 a year for 10 years from a mortgage company in Baltimore. Even better, the mortgage company told him, he could lease the house across the street for just $2,500 more. It was a steal. Then came the hitch. The hitch was named Bill Dwyer. My childhood memories are of a big, distinguished-looking man with rimless glasses, whom I called Mr. Dwyer, and who inexplicably lived with us in the pistachio house. As did his chauffeur, or bodyguard, I never quite knew which he was. And then there was Mrs. Spieler, middle-aged, also distinguished-looking, who, we were told, was the housekeeper. She, too, came with the house. It was not until I read my father's memoir years later that I learned the story of Bill Dwyer. His arrival in the house one December morning in 1939 had simply been announced by Mrs. Spieler. "Mr. Dwyer is here," she said. And there he stood, in front of a pile of suitcases, with his bodyguard chauffeur. My father had heard of Bill Dwyer. He had owned the Palm Island Club and Casino and was known locally as the Fixer. During Prohibition, it was Mr. Dwyer who could arrange to have a shipload of rum land without trouble from the police, and who was the payoff man between the mob and the law. "You took care of Bill. Bill took care of you," my father wrote. And there was the Fixer, in our living room, prepared to move in. There was a rational explanation. Mr. Dwyer had mortgaged and lost the club across the street to the mortgage company in Baltimore and had no claim on that. My father owned it now. But Mr. Dwyer still thought he had a claim on the house, which he had been renting for years. His lease had run out the year before, but it was his understanding that the Baltimore company would not re-rent it without informing him. He hadn't heard from the company, so he had simply come home for the winter months. "They say your life passes in front of you in a flash when you are drowning, that a drowning man clutches at straws," my father wrote about this first encounter with Bill Dwyer. On the one hand, my father had an airtight lease on the house and the nightclub across the street, which was due to open in 2 days. He could have thrown him out. On the other hand, he did not know what Bill Dwyer was thinking behind his big smile, or what role his henchman might play. It seemed inconceivable to my father that he would allow a gangster to live in the house alongside his wife and 2 daughters. But then again, he knew that Mr. Dwyer was president of Tropical Park, a popular racetrack in Miami. He couldn't be all bad. Nor, to the best of my father's knowledge, had Mr. Dwyer murdered anyone or spent time in jail. The house had 7 bedrooms, after all, of which we occupied only 3. The prudent choice, my father decided, was to invite Mr. Dwyer to be his guest in the house until he had sorted it out with the mortgage company, which apparently took until April 1940 because that's when Dwyer, the bodyguard, and Mrs. Spieler disappeared. Welcoming Mr. Dwyer into the house was not the only gamble my father took. There was a risk in opening a Latin Quarter on an island that was accessible only via causeway by car, while so many flashy nightclubs and hotels in Miami Beach were within walking distance of one another. But my father was never one to listen to naysayers, which, in this case, was wise. Lew Walter's Miami Beach Latin Quarter opened on December 23, 1940, and even more sunshine entered our lives. The Latin Quarter was filled to capacity from the night it opened. Later, my father would hire stars like Milton Berle, Martha Ray, Joey Lewis, and Sophie Tucker. But in the beginning, the attraction at the Latin Quarter was the show itself. It was big and lavish, lasting almost 2 hours, performed twice a night, and starring my father's famous can-can girls and showgirls, as well as acrobats, singers, and novelty acts never seen before in Miami. His popular Apache, a French act, mimicked a brawl between a tough lower class man and his women. At the end of the act, one of the women shot the man. In private life, they were a happily married couple. The show was bright, happy, sexy, and glamorous. My father's club quickly became the in spot for vacationers in what was rapidly becoming Paradise by the Sea. During the 30s, a whole bunch of Art Deco hotels had sprung up like palm trees in Miami Beach. Many of them, refurbished and repainted, exist today in what is now called South Beach. Tourism was booming, fueled by the depression-weary snowbirds from northern cities like Chicago, Boston, and New York. The winter population had grown from an estimated 60,000 in 1935 to around 75,000 in 1940. The chauffeured cars pulling up to the marble Latin Quarter entrance disgorged such well-known people as Howard Hughes, the super-rich oil man, movie producer, and aviation tycoon, and Joseph Kennedy, the patriarch of the Kennedy family. In fact, Joe Kennedy became a frequent visitor to the club, driving down from his large home in Palm Beach. He knew my dad from the days of the Latin Quarter in Falmouth, which was a short distance from the Kennedy compound in Hyannis. Mr. Kennedy also used to go to the Latin Quarter in Boston with his political cronies, Governor Curley and Commissioner Tumulty. So it was not surprising that his patronage of the Latin Quarter continued in Florida. He became such a regular that years later, when I went to see him after he'd had a stroke, I was interviewing Rose Kennedy for the Today Show, I introduced myself not as Barbara Walters from the Today Show, but as Barbara Walters, Lou Walters' daughter. Only then did I get a glimmer of recognition. Once I adapted to the big greenhouse, and Mr. Dwyer, and Mrs. Spieler, that first winter in Miami Beach turned out to be one of the happier times of my young life. I am still pained to remember that much of it had to do with the absence of Jackie. My parents had been trying for years to find a place where my sister could be with children who were more or less like her. If I was a somewhat lonely child, you can imagine how lonely life was for Jackie. My parents also hoped that she could get some kind of an education, have some kind of a life. So, after much investigation, they sent her to a boarding school for special needs children in Pennsylvania. This meant that I had my parents all to myself, which was wonderful for me, but agonizing for Jackie. It turned out that she was not retarded enough for the school. She also missed my mother desperately. Jackie came home 6 months after she'd left, and my parents never sent her away again. Even with my sister's return, those were happy days for me, because the Latin Quarter was right across the street from the house, just as our cottage had been in Falmouth. When I got home from school, my mother and often my father were around. I remember my parents dressing to go to the Latin Quarter for dinner and the shows, both of them looking so spiffy. I have memories, too, of leaving for school early in the morning and meeting my parents just coming home. They would kiss me hello or goodbye or both and then go off to bed. None of this seemed unusual to me. If there is one thing that distinguishes that early time in Florida, it is my parents' joy, especially my mother's. I had never seen her so happy, and that, of course, made me happy. My father gave her a beautiful lynx coat to wear on chilly evenings, and she treasured it. I can still picture her in that fluffy coat, looking radiant. It was extremely hard for my mother to live on Palm Island and not be able to drive. She had to be chauffeured everywhere, just as I was driven to elementary school in Miami Beach every morning by the gardener and then picked up every day after school. My mother, if she wanted to buy even a pair of stockings or go to the market, had to be dropped off and picked up again. So, without telling my father, my mother tried to overcome her fears and took driving lessons. I wore braces on my teeth in those days, the ones with elastic bands on each end. I hated them, of course. And my orthodontist was located in Miami, so my mother practiced her driving by taking me to and from the dentist. He had a parking lot, so she didn't have to worry too much about parallel parking, which was not her strength. Then came the big day when my father was returning from a trip to Boston. My mother and I surprised him at the airport, and my mother drove us home. My father was thrilled. My mother drove for a short time after that, but she never really lost her fear. When the city became more crowded, she gave it up. In case you don't believe in parental influence, to this day, I don't drive. It's a real pain in the neck. I did drive shortly after graduating from college. My father even bought me an Oldsmobile convertible. But my mother's fear was deep in me, and I stopped, never to start again. I was always afraid of hitting another car and am still a nervous backseat passenger. Now remember, when I talk about this driving business, that my little friends from school also couldn't drive, and their parents thought it a nuisance to drive them to and from Palm Island, so the girlfriends I made at school rarely came home to play with me. Guess who became my new best friend? Mr. Dwyer. What can I say? He took a shine to me. He went to his racetrack every day and often took me with him on weekends. I wasn't allowed inside the track because I was too young, but we parked where I could see the horses. I would give Mr. Dwyer the few dollars my father had given me, and Mr. Dwyer would make bets for me. Magically, I always won. One of the things I hope happens as a result of this book is that I somehow get answers to questions that have puzzled me for years. Like, what became of Mr. Dwyer after he left our house? And who was the chauffeur bodyguard who shared his bedroom? Is it possible that Mr. Dwyer was gay? In those days, the only reference to gay I'd ever heard was in the Latin Quarter's theme song, "So This Is Gay Paris." But in retrospect, it seems somewhat logical. I don't remember my parents ever talking about him again after that year, and I haven't really thought about Mr. Dwyer until now, but I'd love to know the truth about him. I did have one friend from school, Phyllis Fine, whose show business father, Larry Fine, was one of the now legendary Three Stooges. They lived in a hotel in Miami Beach. Phyllis was pretty and blonde, and like me, was alone a lot. She would sometimes come to visit me on Palm Island, and occasionally I would sleep over at the hotel with her, but those visits were rare. Again, we had to be picked up, waited for, and driven home. School was a whole new challenge. I entered 3 months into the school year. The curriculum was entirely foreign to me. I had teachers who didn't know me from Adam, let alone Eve. They not only had to cope with me and what I knew or didn't know, but with a whole bunch of other kids whose parents had come to Miami Beach just for the winter months. It was a public school, not too big, and co-ed. But I was a shy, introverted child, and I felt I had to audition for a new role I didn't know how to play. I coped by doing more homework than was probably necessary, and hoping that this would be a day when Phyllis and I could play together. The dress code also bothered me. It was, after all, Florida, sunny and warm, and many of the girls in my class wore shorts. We were in the dark ages before the universal wearing of jeans. But I thought my legs were too skinny to be displayed, so shorts were not for me. I wore blouses and skirts. My mother and I went to Lincoln Road, the chic shopping street in Miami Beach, and we bought a whole new wardrobe. We packed away the heavy sweaters and mostly plaid wool skirts I had worn in Brookline, but we didn't buy one pair of shorts. I don't remember any sporting activities. You would think we would go to the beach and swim now and then, but we never did. It was okay with me not to have sports. I have never been particularly athletic. Overall, the school was an all right experience for me. Not great, not bad, not memorable. I adjusted pretty well. After doing my homework when I got home from school, I played with my dolls. I absolutely loved my doll's house and could play for hours in happy solitude. I was also, then as now, a voracious reader and could easily get lost for hours in a book. Then, too, the island was one of the attractions on the sightseeing boat tours around Biscayne Bay, and I would often wander down to the dock and sit there, alone, waving at the passing tourists. A bigger adventure was to ride my bike past Al Capone's house, hoping to catch a glimpse of the infamous Public Enemy Number One, though I never did. Having spent the last 8 years in jail for tax evasion, Capone had arrived back at his house on Palm Island in 1939 at about the same time we did. He was much more of a gangster than Mr. Dwyer. Al Capone had been a massive bootlegger, alleged murderer, and the Chicago gang leader who was thought to have masterminded the 1929 St. Valentine's Day massacre, in which 7 rival gang members were gunned down. By the time he returned to Palm Island, he was sick with late-stage syphilis and suffering from dementia, but I didn't know anything about that. Nor, apparently, did my father, who wrote that Al Capone was an occasional visitor to the Latin Quarter, where he sat at the bar, sipped a club soda, and paid with a $20 bill out of the wad of new bills in his pocket. He never interfered with anyone, and believe me, no one wanted to interfere with him, my father wrote. When Al Capone died in 1947, as peacefully as if he were a buttonhole maker, my father recalled, there was just a bartender to mourn his passing. As I write about my young life on Palm Island, it sounds rather like Eloise at the Plaza, except that Palm Island was no chic hotel, nor did Eloise spend days at a racetrack and weekend evenings in a nightclub lighting booth. Unlike the Latin Quarter in Boston and later in New York, the club in Florida was not a place for family celebrations. The shows were sophisticated and not for children, so I hid away in the small lighting booth high above the dance floor where the main electrician controlled the onstage lights. Crouched next to the technician, I watched the shows weekend after weekend until I could do practically all the numbers. My sister's escape when she finally came home was to go backstage and sit in the dressing room with the chorus girls, who were very kind to her. I was uncomfortable doing that and preferred the lighting booth. As I said, in the first year of the Latin Quarter, my dad didn't hire big stars. He wasn't sure he could afford them. But the second year, Jimmy Durante played the club. So did Sophie Tucker, known as the last of the Red Hot Mamas, belting out her theme song, "You're Gonna Miss Your Red Hot Mama Some of These Days." Milton Berle played there, too. I saw his act so many times, I can still do it practically in my sleep. Want to hear the opening lines? He would walk up to the standing microphone, touch it, then jump back as if in shock and say, "I've just been goosed by Westinghouse." By the way, this early education has never come in particularly handy, and I never did learn how to maneuver those huge white feather fans that the scantily clad Sally Rand, a very well-known exotic dancer, swished back and forth in her famous peekaboo fan dance. One of my other favorite acts was not well-known. His name was Emil Borio. He spoke with a heavy accent and did an act that seems quite odd to me today. He wore a soft felt hat with a big brim and by changing the brim said he could be anyone. Here, as I remember it more than 60 years later, is the opening of his act. "It's not what I do. It's not what I say. It's the way I wear my hat. I can be most anyone with a twist of my brim like that." Then he would turn that hat into a Frenchman's beret or an Englishman's bowler. How come no one wants me to do this act today? Then there was the brilliant Spanish ventriloquist who years later many readers will remember from the Ed Sullivan Show, Señor Wences. I can do his routine, too. He would make a fist and with his thumb around his fingers, color his closed finger with lipstick for a mouth, make 2 eyes with black chalk, and create his so-called little friend named Johnny, or as Señor Wences pronounced the name, Yanni. Yanni was fresh and funny, and he tormented the kind, dignified Señor Wences, who also had another talking companion, a head in a wooden box. Every time Señor Wences opened the box, Yanni would say, "Close the box," and the head would say, "Open the box." I am not making this up. I guess I should also tell you that I managed to learn all this and still pass all my tests at school. But the real crowd pleaser, as usual, was my father's parade of gorgeous showgirls who would walk around the stage wearing huge multicolored headdresses and little else. Complete nudity was as illegal as gambling in Miami Beach, and these gorgeous Amazons wore tiny sequined pasties to hide their nipples and used feathers, sequins, and sometimes little fur muffs to cover their G-strings. One of the sensations at an early Palm Island Latin Quarter show was a Chinese girl who carried a real little black kitten in a fur-lined muff over her private parts. In my innocence, I fixated on the kitten and wanted to take it home. I also loved the dancers or ponies who would strut their stuff on the stage, whirling, high-kicking, doing my father's version of the can-can before dropping to the floor in a split. I tried that routine at home once and practically dismembered myself. My father had three golden rules for his girls. One, do your best show even if it's only a rehearsal. Two, don't get tan. A rule inspired by Twinny, one of the showgirls who loved to sun herself on the roof of the Palm Island Club, which set her apart from her pale twin sister, Winnie, in the show's Parade of the Wooden Soldiers. Your father didn't want to have a chocolate soldier and a vanilla soldier, Twinny told me years later. Rule number three, don't get fat. I saw all this through the prism of a child's eyes. It took me years to recognize that my father was a sorcerer of magic and fantasy, although the audiences got it from the beginning. What I did learn at this young age was that behind these fantasy figures were real people. They may have been glamorous on stage, but I saw them off stage without their costumes and makeup, and they had problems, just like everyone else. I knew that Sophie Tucker had a son she rarely saw, that Sally Rand was sick of her fan dance, even though it had made her famous, that many of the chorus girls had families they were supporting. This gave me an understanding of celebrities that I never would have had. As a result, I was not in awe, years and years later, when I began doing interviews with big-name stars. Those early years at the Latin Quarter also affected the way I later asked questions and listened to answers. I knew that the childhood years of most celebrities were their most poignant and could often explain their future choices, as, of course, it has mine. I learned when to be quiet and just listen. And I knew what could bring tears. Now, I have been so often accused of making celebrities cry that I go out of my way not to bring on the tears. You cry on this program and I won't run any of it, I once warned Robin Williams as he pretended to weep. You may think it odd that I am writing so much about my father and the Latin Quarter when this is my memoir, but that nightclub controlled our lives. Everything we did revolved around it. Everything we owned, every meal we ate, the shirts on our back, so to speak, stemmed from the Latin Quarter. The Walters and the Latin Quarter were inseparable. The rest of the family, too, gravitated toward Palm Island. Aunt Lena often came to visit us. Uncle Max, my mother's brother, was already working for my father, so he was there, too. So, for 6 months, was another of her brothers, Uncle Dan Seletsky. He had had an operation just before the Latin Quarter's second season, and my father not only gave him an apartment on the property to recuperate in, but gave his wife, Aunt Anne, a job. She became my father's office manager. The success of the Palm Island Latin Quarter continued to grow, and with it my father's reputation as a brilliant showman. He became such a darling of the local papers that nationally syndicated columnists started mentioning the Latin Quarter in their columns. One such all-important columnist and radio broadcaster was Walter Winchell, who practically invented the gossip column. The more my father appeared in print, the greater his reputation grew. The combination of the two led to a new offer. The way my father tells the story in his memoir, he was sitting alone in the Palm Island Latin Quarter on New Year's Day 1941, when a press agent named Irving Zussman approached him. How'd you like to run a nightclub on Broadway, in Times Square, the best location in the world, and you won't have to put up a cent? The space was available for a 10-year lease, Zussman told him, and there was a backer who wanted to get into the nightclub business, a millionaire named E.M. Lowe, who owned a circuit of movie houses. My father had known Lowe for 25 years. He had booked vaudeville acts into some of Lowe's theaters. Lowe would put up all the money. My father would produce the shows. They would be partners. My mother was skeptical. Another risk. Why not let well enough alone? But my father's eyes were dancing. He had seen the building, which had been a fancy Chinese restaurant called the Palais d'Or, then the Post Harlem Cotton Club, then the Gay White Way. None of those nightclubs succeeded, but it could seat between 600 and 700 people, and my optimistic father felt he had the magic touch. So, without further thought, my father made a deal with the tight-fisted E.M. Lowe, whom he would later deem as fine a gentleman as ever hated to pay a bill. So, for better or worse, we were on the move again. It was time to audition in a new city, at a new school, for new friends. This time, we were off to New York. New York, New York. I think the problem was my Cuban heels. My entree into New York did not go well as I started the 8th grade at Fieldston, my third school in as many years. Cuban heels had nothing to do with Havana or Miami. Mine were open-toed shoes with 1-inch-high square heels that were the rage for young girls and were meant to be worn on dress-up evenings with silk stockings with seams down the back. The shoes were usually brown or black. During the day, one wore either brown loafers or laced-up saddle shoes. Saddle shoes were white with brown sides, and with them you wore ankle socks. Now, this digression about footwear is to tell you that I had the whole deal messed up. I guess I had heard about the Cuban heels, but coming from Miami, my mother and I bought the shoes in white. The Miami stores didn't carry them in black. To make matters worse, I wore the open-toed shoes, not with the prescribed silk stockings, but with white ankle socks. So I arrived that first day particularly dressed up, not knowing a soul in the school, and looking like some hick, which, of course, I was. I also, in those days, had a strong Boston accent. It was long before the Kennedys made the accent fashionable, and to the New Yorkers I sounded affected, saying can't and aunt instead of can't and aunt. Fieldston was then, and is now, a highly respected and difficult-to-get-into private school. I was amazed that my mother even knew about it and sent in an application. The main school is located in Riverdale, on the outskirts of the city. It also has an elementary school in Manhattan, and most of the kids had been going to the school since kindergarten or first grade. It was co-ed and full of cliques. This girl was best friends with that girl. This was the girl all the boys liked. This was the A group. This group didn't matter. I was most definitely in the latter group. In the beginning, the toughest part of the day was lunch in the school cafeteria. I would take my tray and slowly walk around the room, hoping that one of the A group would look up and ask me to sit down. Whomever you sat with for lunch defined your social standing. But even after I dumped the white Cuban heels for saddle shoes, I never really made the A group. I was more or less a B or C+. But we social underlings could occasionally ask one of the A girls for a date on a Saturday afternoon. We actually made dates, real dates. You would ask a girl if she wanted to spend Saturday with you, and then if she said yes, you would have lunch and usually go to the movies. In those days, New York had dozens of movie theaters all around Broadway with great big stage shows. Broadway was very safe, and there were so many other places a teenager could go. There was Radio City Music Hall with its famed chorus line of high-kicking rockettes. There were all the theaters hosting the big bands, Tommy Dorsey, Glenn Miller, Benny Goodman. Singing with Dorsey's band was a skinny, hollow-cheeked, bow-tied fellow named Frank Sinatra, who looked as if a strong wind would blow him away. But he sang love songs like no one else, and the young girls went wild. Sinatra's adolescent fans, including me, were dubbed Bobby Soxers, from, obviously, our short socks. When Sinatra appeared solo at the Paramount Theater in 1942, my mother, Jackie, and I stood in line to get tickets to see him. His appearance created such hysteria among young girls, including fits of swooning, that newspapers turned to psychiatrists for explanations. I didn't swoon. but I loved his voice then and always. 2 years later, his return to the Paramount caused what became known as the Columbus Day Riot. On his opening day in October 1944, 10,000 Bobby Soxers jammed the ticket line and an estimated 20,000 others piled into Times Square, breaking windows in the crush. Sinatra burst into the nation's awareness in a way that would not be matched until the arrival of Elvis Presley in the 50s and then the Beatles in the 60s. By the way, several years later, when Sinatra had lost his popularity and before his legendary comeback, he played the Latin Quarter. But the point of all this is that a person, young or old, could go to a movie and watch the stage show and spend the whole day being entertained. And what a treat if you were going with one of the popular girls. To this day, I remember the sort of adoring court that formed around those girls. One A-group member was tiny and graceful with little hands and feet. Another, the class beauty, had long blonde hair to her waist and a perfect pompadour. The look back then, hair swept high off the face in a big roll. The really older boys, the 15-year-olds, thought she was divine. Years and years later, I met her again. She didn't look as great, and I was already on the Today Show. Okay, so I'm bragging, but after all those years of pushing so hard, I'm entitled. It isn't that I was a dog in those days, but I saw myself as too thin, and my pompadour never looked quite right. Slowly, though, I did make good friends, and the B-list had some good kids. Also, slowly, I began to like my life in New York. My family started off living in a residential hotel called the Buckingham, located at 57th Street and 6th Avenue, since renamed the Avenue of the Americas, although I've never heard a New Yorker refer to it that way. It was in the heart of the city, one block from one of my favorite places, the Automat. The legendary brainchild of Horn and Hardart, the Automat had branches all over New York, and it was like a big cafeteria. Only a lot of the food, the sandwiches, the salads, the pieces of pie, were behind little glass doors. You put your nickels into a slot and the door opened to present you with the dish of your choice. The Automat had a memorable slogan, "Less work for mother," and was not only great fun, but a brilliant forerunner of today's fast food chains. Some of the Automat's patrons stayed all day, especially those with little money. They would eat the free saltines and ketchup that were on the tables, get a tea bag and some hot water, and hang around for hours. After a while, we recognized these regulars. We would smile at them, and they would smile at us. The Automat was such a part of the New York scene that when Horn and Hardart finally closed its doors, the last one on 42nd Street and 3rd Avenue closed in 1991, editorials were written, and the old-timers actually grieved. My problem, as ever, was Jackie. First of all, Jackie and I had to share a bedroom, but a larger problem was that she had nothing to do. During the week, I went to school, and whatever my mother did or wherever my mother went, Jackie went too. By now, she was a teenager. My mother, her heart aching at the loneliness of my sister, would often look at me pleadingly when I had one of my coveted Saturday afternoon dates and ask me to take Jackie along. I can still hear my mother's voice. "Can't you take your sister? It would mean so much to her." My mother probably shouldn't have done it, but she loved both of her daughters, and one of them was so alone. Me? I was just ashamed, intolerant and ashamed. When Jackie stuttered trying to get a word out or didn't seem able to join in the conversation, my friends would look uncomfortable. "What school does she go to?" they would question me. The next day they would ask me, shyly, if Jackie could dress herself. What did it mean to be slow or retarded? Did that mean she was crazy? Today, it's hard to understand how much ignorance there was, but subjects like this were not discussed. If you had a child like my sister, you did what my parents did, protect her, and hope no one would notice. It must have been so difficult for my sister. She would have great spells of crying, tantrums of frustration, and especially in later years, scream at my mother. But she never turned her anger on me. I can't say the same for myself. I could be short or angry with her, and to this day I regret every harsh word I said to her. Why didn't I take my sister to the movies on a Saturday afternoon? There I was, her younger sister, with everything. And there was Jackie, with so little. The phone rang for me, but never for her. Friends came to see me, but not her. I even got her clothes. As Jackie and I grew older, she grew plumper, and if the new clothes my mother bought for her didn't fit, I got them. Why didn't she hate me? I don't know, but she never did. If conditions at home were difficult, conditions on Broadway and 48th Street were not. The New York Latin Quarter opened on April 22, 1942, 4 months after the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor and we entered World War II. The government started rationing gas and we were issued ration cards for food. We even had blackout nights when we pulled down our shades and turned down the lights in case an enemy plane flew over the city. That would seem to have been an inauspicious time to launch a nightclub, but the reality was quite the opposite. The opulent fantasy world my father had created, red velvet-lined walls, a thickly quilted pink ceiling, fountains spouting colored water, mirrors on the staircase, and indirect lighting seeping through ostrich feathers, turned out to be the perfect antidote to the harsh wartime world outside the club's mauve double doors. In its first year, the standing room only club grossed $1.6 million. A huge number in those days. The Saturday Evening Post noted the phenomenon a year after the Latin Quarter opened. It became one of the most amazing operations in Broadway history, and no one could figure out how Walters had done it. My father knew, of course, and he didn't hesitate to share his formula in one magazine article after another. "Everything in a nightclub should be a little bit better than you can afford," he said, describing the club's opulent decor. As for the customers, "Fill them full of food and take their breath away. Don't let them relax and feel normal for a minute. The man who goes to a nightclub goes in the spirit of splurging, and you've got to splurge right along with him." What made the Latin Quarter's success a true phenomenon was its success in the face of great competition. In this pre-TV era of nightclubs, the Latin Quarter was just one of many famous clubs in New York. There was, first and foremost, the Copacabana. Owned, it was said, by the mob. The mafia had nothing to do with the Latin Quarter. The mob was very active in Las Vegas, but my father, remember, had come from Boston and started as a small-time booking agent. Their paths had not crossed. He had no dealings with these men and barely knew them when he opened his nightclubs. I used to joke sometimes that I wish he had known them, because we would have been a lot richer. The Copa was in the basement of a hotel just off Fifth Avenue and always hazy from cigarette smoke. But it had the most beautiful line of girls, the celebrated Copa girls. They could barely dance, but they didn't have to. They just smiled and walked slowly and looked gorgeous. The Copa would later be the nightclub where a hilarious young comedy team, Jerry Lewis and Dean Martin, played season after season to packed houses. Then there was the ever-so-chic Stork Club. No dancing girls, but nearly impossible to get into. The much-feared gossip columnist who had first noticed and written about my father, Walter Winchell, had his own table there every night. There was also the exclusive high-society El Morocco, with its signature zebra-patterned banquettes and its powerful maitre d', who kept customers waiting for hours behind a velvet rope while he let in celebrities like Errol Flynn and Humphrey Bogart. El Morocco had dancing, but no show. The famous patrons were the show. Billy Rose's famous Diamond Horseshoe was my father's main competition because it, too, had a big show and chorus girls. What set the Latin Quarter apart was the modest price. A $2 minimum and an average dinner tab of $8 a person, which could include shrimp cocktail, salad, steak, and dessert. And while most of the other clubs were definitely for adults only, the New York Latin Quarter, unlike the Palm Island Latin Quarter, welcomed families. It became the club of choice for high school seniors after their proms, and for their grandmother's birthdays, servicemen on leave, many of whom over the years have sent me their old Latin Quarter photos, also flocked to the club. My father didn't charge them. The Latin Quarter was such an important fixture in the cultural history of New York that more than 60 years later, Mayor Michael Bloomberg, after a vote by the city council, changed the name of 48th Street and Broadway, where the Latin Quarter reigned for 2 decades, to Lew Walters Way. I went to the unveiling ceremony, presided over by the mayor, on a beautiful spring morning in April 2006. When my father died, we never had a memorial. In a way, this was it. I found out who among my father's chorus girls was still alive. They were in their 70s and 80s, and I invited them. 12 of them came, including the still beautiful movie actress Arlene Dahl, who had been in the chorus when she was 18, and the irrepressible former can-can dancers, the identical twins Twinnie and Winnie, now octogenarians, who stood on either side of the mayor and in front of the photographers, kicked a leg straight up over their heads, revealing their lacy underwear. The mayor turned red and burst out laughing, as did we all on that happy occasion. 2 of the showgirls wore their old costumes, at least parts of them, and showed up in their headdresses and feather boas. They brought treasures, like old photographs of themselves as much younger showgirls at the Latin Quarter, and had many fond memories of my father. I took them to lunch after the ceremony, and one after another told me that my father was the kindest and gentlest of bosses. They adored him. Which is why, even now, 6 decades and counting after the Latin Quarter closed, the chorus girls still have annual reunions and reminisce about what they describe as the best years of their lives. When I can, I join them. When I was a kid, however, I didn't feel the pride for my father that I would later with Mayor Bloomberg. The Latin Quarter may have been a special treat for everybody and his uncle, but not for me. I was old enough to recognize how other families lived, and they were not like mine. The fathers came home every night to have dinner with the stay-at-home mothers and the children. Cousins, aunts, and uncles gathered in their dining rooms for Thanksgiving and Christmas. Other kids had birthday parties at home and invited all their friends. We did none of that. We celebrated every Thanksgiving, Christmas, New Year's, and all our birthdays at the Latin Quarter. My father coming home for dinner once a week on Fridays was almost the only time I saw him. Other nights he came home long after I was asleep, and he himself slept late into the morning. My father, I realize now, did try to include us in his life. Although the featured acts might change every 2 weeks, the big, elaborate productions usually changed just twice a year. When that happened, my mother, Jackie, and I went with him on opening night. We sat at his table nearest the door, and he would spend most of the show talking over an intercom on the table to the lighting technicians or to Madame Kamarova, his longtime production director and choreographer. For the most part, I just sat there quietly and only roused myself with my mother to critique each new show. We usually forgot to tell my father how great it was, and God knows I myself know today how much one wants to hear praise after a performance. Instead, more often than not, we told him only what was wrong. On some level, I guess I was punishing him for not being the father next door. I even refused to pay much attention to the influential Broadway columnists who stopped by our table. Ed Sullivan, Leonard Lyons, Earl Wilson, Louis Sobel, sometimes even Walter Winchell. My silence must have hurt my father, who in turn hurt me. "Your problem is that you have an inferiority complex," he told me on one of those evenings. "That's why you never want to talk to anybody." Jackie, on the other hand, loved the Latin Quarter. It became her home away from home, and she would spend whatever time she was allowed to backstage with the chorus girls. They were wonderfully kind to her, as in years to come were many of the big stars my father hired, particularly Frank Sinatra, Carol Channing, and the singer Johnny Ray. Johnny Ray was famous for his song, "The Little White Cloud That Cried," and Jackie developed a serious crush on him. He in turn reciprocated by calling her Jackie Darling and sending her birthday cards and autographed pictures from wherever he was on tour. Perhaps it was because he too had a childhood disability, he was partially deaf and wore a hearing aid. Jackie felt that Johnny Ray was as in love with her as she was with him. Years after her death, I read her diary. Jackie could write, not well, but certainly legibly. The diary was laced with references to him, such as, "Johnny is working in Chicago. Hope he calls me. Johnny is in Dallas. Someday I will marry him." So touching was that diary that I could barely look through it. Even today, reading it for this book brought me to tears. When Jackie wasn't at the Latin Quarter, she was at the movies with my mother. Any movie, night after night, just the two of them. The empty days and nights must have seemed endless to both of them. Around this time, my parents tried hiring companions for Jackie, but they disagreed about what kind of companion to hire. My father wanted someone more like Jackie, perhaps a bit slow herself. My mother wanted someone who would be more responsible and teach Jackie to read or write better. Neither type worked out. If the companion was bright, as several were, the friend for hire had nothing in common with Jackie, leaving my sister just as isolated. But the few borderline companions were also failures. They were apt to forget about Jackie for their own pleasures. I remember one time Jackie and a companion went to the skating rink at Rockefeller Center. They skated around a bit, and then the companion picked up some guy skating alone and left Jackie for hours on her own. When Jackie finally came home, she told my parents, and that was that. So after a while, my parents gave up this experiment and again kept Jackie to themselves. Only once do I remember my parents ever having a holiday without her. They left Jackie with a chorus girl named Baby Lake, an adorable person whom we all liked, and went off to the Bahamas. But my parents telephoned home 3 times a day. All this naturally put a great strain on their marriage. In Florida, the close proximity of the Palm Island Club to our pistachio house afforded them time to be together, but that was not the case in New York. After our first few months at the Buckingham, we moved into a magnificent penthouse on Central Park West. We would live in a series of penthouses over the years, but my mother rarely saw my father. He spent his nights at the Latin Quarter, his mornings asleep in the apartment, and his afternoons playing cards at the Friars Club, the renowned hangout for men in show business. Money became an issue again between my parents. For all that the New York Latin Quarter was a runaway success, the productions were very expensive. Each cost $75,000 to $80,000, a huge amount in those days, and the profit margin slim. My father was very generous. He never put my mother on an allowance, as some husbands did. But she was always afraid that something would happen to the club, or that my father would lose too heavily at cards and they'd wind up broke again. This fear was communicated to me from an early age. I became consumed with the same worry. What would we do when the money ran out? I can remember my parents arguing about putting some money into savings, about buying insurance, about making secure investments. My father's response? He went off and produced a series of very expensive musical revues on Broadway. He wanted to be an even bigger success. His first Broadway extravaganza at the Winter Garden Theater was the Ziegfeld Follies of 1943, a revival of the hugely successful musical revues that the great showman Florence Ziegfeld had produced annually from 1907 to 1931. My father's version was very similar to the show at the Latin Quarter, except even more extravagant. I went with my parents on opening night, and the next morning we held our breath hoping the reviews would be good. They weren't. But the wartime audiences loved it and kept it running for an impressive 523 performances. That experience convinced my father to go after more projects on the Great White Way. In short order, he wrote, produced, and directed Artists and Models, an updated vaudeville review from the 1920s. The show opened at the Broadway Theater on November 5, 1943, and starred a then-famous singer named Jane Froman, who had lost the use of her legs in a plane accident. She was wheeled onto the stage in a specially built wheelchair. Artists and Models also starred a young comedian named Jackie Gleason. But despite the best efforts of its stars and a very funny Gleason, it closed 3 weeks later. My father lost a lot of money, but that didn't deter him. Less than 3 months later, he revived and produced another early review, Take a Bow. Even its star, Chico Marx of the famed Marx Brothers, couldn't save it. The show closed after 14 performances. Thousands more dollars of my father's money were lost. So here is how we were. My father, a gambler and a dreamer. My mother, a realist whom my father considered a pessimist. Me? I was a worrier whom both parents considered to be too serious for a very young girl. It all came to a head one afternoon when I returned from school to find my mother in tears.
"Daddy has left us," she told me. "You go talk to him. Tell him to come back."
Being their go-between was not an unfamiliar role for me. My mother often used me to convey whatever grievance she had.
"You talk to Daddy," she would say,
and I would try to get to him on those Friday nights when he was home. Most often, everything turned out all right, but this seemed far more serious than usual. My mother asked me to take my sister, perhaps to create more sympathy. So I took Jackie's hand, and off we went to the Latin Quarter. I remember very clearly sitting with my father at his table in that darkened, empty nightclub, crying and begging him not to leave us. Jackie, too, was crying, although she was not completely sure what was going on. I learned many years later that my father was said to be having an affair with one of his showgirls. If true, I certainly can't judge him too harshly. Let's face it, it would have made sense. Most people in show business were, and are, romantically involved with other people in show business. My father was surrounded by the most beautiful young women, and he was married to an ordinary middle-aged woman. For her part, my mother would probably have been happier married to a man who worked in the dress business, who brought home a paycheck every week and lived a stable life. But we didn't know anything about a showgirl then. My father didn't say anything during my plea. He kissed Jackie and me and simply said he had to go back to work. I didn't know what to do. I definitely didn't know what to tell my mother. So I took Jackie to a movie with a stage show playing nearby. I dreaded returning home, and we sat in the theater for hours. But when we did go home, my mother was smiling. She told me my father had changed his mind and decided not to leave. My anguish was over. I didn't understand then what had made the difference, but I do today. For all his gambling and extravagance, my father was a principled and decent man. He also loved his introverted, shy younger daughter and his touching and sweet older daughter. How could he just walk out and leave us? It is also possible that in his own way, he loved his wife. He certainly respected her. The crisis passed. I finished that first year at Fieldston in pretty good shape. I got A's and B's in most of my subjects, but I was lousy at gym. I envied the girls with their hockey sticks running across the field, madly chasing after the ball. They were a breed apart. I always thought, not especially kindly, of this particular kind of girl, confident and athletic, as a hockey player. I wished then that I, too, were an athlete. It would have given me some sort of positive identity as a newcomer to the school. But there it was, and is. I have never been good at any sport, be it basketball, volleyball, soccer, you name it. I never learned to play tennis. I was bored when I tried golf. I won't drown in the water, but don't ask me to do a backflip into the pool. That lack of athletic expertise followed me to sleepaway camp. The summer of my first year in New York, I went off to the Poconos with my New Jersey cousin, Helen. She was a terrific girl, and I liked her a lot. So, obviously, did everyone else. At the end of the 6 weeks we were away, Helen was voted not only best athlete, but best all-around camper. This was the kind of camp that felt every child should go home with some award to show their parents. Therefore, I was voted most improved athlete. Need I say more? Although I did well at Fieldston, the school, it turned out, was having a problem with me. It had to do with my father's shows. Every time a new show opened at the Latin Quarter or on Broadway, my mother, Jackie, and I attended. Often, after the show, we would go with my father to Lindy's, a famous late-night delicatessen. All the show folks in town seemed to end up there, especially the comedians. They all knew my father and made a fuss over Jackie and me. This meant that we got home very late, and my mother then would keep me home the next day so I could sleep. Even though I was a good student, the school disapproved of the days I missed. They told my parents that if I wanted to return to Fieldston the next year, I would not be allowed to skip so much school. As it happened, it wasn't something we had to consider. At the end of the school year, my father told us we would again be pulling up stakes and leaving what I'd come to think of as home. I was furious. I had finally made friends. I had a life. Once again, I was having to leave it all behind. As the song goes, another opening of another show. For me, another audition. For my father, a new challenge. The Latin Quarter was doing so well in New York that it didn't need his constant attention, and he had another project in mind. Would you believe it? We were going back to Miami Beach. Miami at War. The last time I had gone to school in Miami Beach, the only noises I heard outside the classroom were the shouts and laughter from the older kids who had recess an hour after we did. This time, the sounds that resonated were loud masculine voices repeating in unison, sound off 1, 2, sound off 3, 4. It was 1944, America's third year in World War II. While I was in high school, the Army was ensconced in virtually every hotel in Miami Beach. They had commandeered almost 400 of them to house the thousands of servicemen being trained under the palm trees and along the pristine beaches to go to war. The U.S. military had taken over paradise, and there was no room anymore for tourists. The Army was in Miami Beach. Across the causeways, the Navy was headquartered in Miami. I even remember seeing open trucks carrying German soldiers who were prisoners of war. The Germans weren't marching or counting off. Dressed in jeans and shirts with PW stenciled on the backs, they were being taken to clean the streets in Miami Beach. There must have been prisoner of war camps nearby. But was Miami Beach a paradise for the German prisoners of war? I doubt it. Then again, I didn't give it much thought. As I look back, I didn't give anything much thought other than my own personal life. Strangely enough, I wasn't sure then and still don't know why my father wanted to return to Miami Beach. The Latin Quarter on Palm Island had been requisitioned by the Army as one of its many commissaries to feed the trainees. The pistachio greenhouse had also been militarized. It was now living quarters for some lucky officers. Our family, however, continued to live on an island, a different one, off the same causeway. Just a short bike ride away from Palm Island, over a little bridge, was Hibiscus Island. Here my father and mother rented a beautiful white house with a lovely lawn and a swimming pool. So without the Latin Quarter, what were we doing there? I guess my father felt that there was still business to be done, for he rented another club called the Colonial Inn on the outskirts of Miami. It is not clear to me how long Dad ran the Colonial Inn. There were very few visitors to Miami or Miami Beach because it was almost impossible to get hotel rooms. Perhaps my father felt that he could attract the Palm Beach crowd just an hour and a half away. There was far less of a military presence there, although how he expected people to drive to his club with such strict wartime gas rationing puzzles me. But I wasn't thinking too much about my father's problems that year. I was in a new school, and this time the auditioning wasn't too tough. I still knew some kids from our last stint in Florida, and my classmates were nowhere near as snobbish as those in my first year at Fieldston. I probably still had my white Cuban heels. Not that there weren't also cliques. Here, the cliques were called sororities and fraternities. They had Greek names, and the deal was this. At the start of each school year, the older girls and boys of a particular sorority or fraternity invited some of the new kids to join. Ever since this experience, I have always felt that sororities and fraternities are exclusionary, discriminating, and hurtful. But remember that Robin who wanted so badly to belong back in second grade? Nothing had really changed. The more exclusive of the girls' sororities was called Kappa Pi. The lesser sorority was called Lambda Pi. I started off at the beginning of the school year and was told that Lambda chose its members first, but if I waited, I would certainly be asked to join Kappa Pi. I was afraid, though, that if I waited, I might not be chosen by either, and that was something I couldn't face. So as soon as I was asked to pledge Lambda Pi, I said yes. Pledging meant giving your total commitment to the group and rejecting friendship with any of the girls in Kappa Pi. Ridiculous? Not at the time. I belonged. I was part of the chorus. I had friends. And I had a good time that year. In case you're wondering if any black, colored was the term in those days, girls or boys were asked to pledge, remember that in the 1940s, there were strict segregation laws in the South. Miami Beach was definitely the South, so the answer is a resounding no. But we weren't thinking of social issues then, only our own small social lives, which were busy and active. We had after-school dances where I learned to do the jitterbug, or, as it was also called, the Lindy. Once in a while now, when I go to a wedding and the band strikes up the music of the 40s, I watch the 60 or 70-year-old men take to the floor with glee, twirl their wives around, and all but throw them over their shoulders. Once you learn the Lindy, you never forget how to do it. I still wouldn't wear shorts to school as many of the other girls did, although, believe me, my legs were probably my best feature. Even today, I think of Marlene Dietrich, who supposedly said, "The legs are the last to go." I had a few boyfriends. One, I remember, was named Ed Klein. We didn't go steady, as the term for exclusivity was then, but we saw a lot of each other. He was in the class above me. When Ed grew up, he became a judge in Miami, and a few years ago he wrote and asked if he and his wife could come to watch my daytime television show, The View. I introduced him from the audience, and he still seemed like a real nice guy. Jackie was, by then, a very pretty girl in her late teens, still always by my mother's side. Now and then friends of the family would tell us about a soldier or sailor they knew from Boston or New York and suggest we call him. I saw a bit of one sweet guy, still in his teens, who was in the army. With my mother still asking, "Can't you take your sister?" a double date was arranged with a friend of my new friend. We went to one of the hotels where servicemen could go to relax. Jackie was quiet, and although I was never very comfortable with her, being the technically younger but ever watchful and emotionally older sister, things seemed to be going pretty well. Until, that is, I heard her date asking Jackie to leave us and go off with him alone for a drink. Jackie didn't know what to say or do. I did. I said, "We're going home." I was afraid that Jackie, in her inexperience and innocence, would be taken advantage of. Did I spoil things for her? She never said a word, so I just don't know. But I didn't want to take the chance. There was another man who was interested in Jackie, and when we got to know him well and trusted him, my parents let him take her out to a few movies. His name was Bert something. He was older, in his late 20s, and I don't remember how he came into our lives. He was a perfectly pleasant man, not good-looking, a bit short and plump, but he had a very cheery disposition, and my mother, in particular, liked him a lot. He seemed to be very attracted to Jackie. He talked patiently to her, and something might have come of it, but Jackie showed no interest. Bert continued to visit for a while, then gradually went out of our lives. I don't remember any other man ever coming around to see her. And although I feel that I am intruding into her very personal being as I write this, I am sure my sister lived her whole life as a virgin. What I remember most about that period in Florida is not Jackie being with Bert, but Jackie again being alone, while I was not. This is, of course, a recurring theme in my life. I had a big pool party once at the Hibiscus Island House for my sorority pals and their dates. There was food, music, dancing, a big deal. We were playing Benny Goodman and Tommy Dorsey records and Lindying away when, at one point, I had to go into the house. There, sitting quietly, were my mother and Jackie. My mother was holding Jackie's hand as they listened silently to the music drifting in from my party. My mother, knowing how I felt and wanting me to have a good time, did not, this time, ask me to include my sister, nor did I offer to. It is difficult for me to admit all this, and it makes me feel wretched just thinking about my selfishness. But in general, I have to say that that year was a happy one for me. We girls of Lambda Pi had get-togethers at one another's houses and planned events with the boys from the fraternities. We went to the beach and to movies. We experimented with makeup. Tangy Natural was the lipstick of choice. You could really smear it on heavily and it still looked like your own lips. Now and then we had dances at school. I still had to be picked up and dropped off. And with gas rationing, this was no easy thing, so sometimes I stayed over at a friend's house. That was a real treat. I should mention that my grades were excellent. I was even chosen Miss French Club, whatever that meant. It was certainly better than most improved athlete. Things were definitely okay. Then on May 8, 1945, Miami erupted into a giant celebration when the Allies officially declared victory over the Germans in Europe. The defeat of the Japanese in the Pacific was still 3 months away, but for the thousands of servicemen in Miami, VE Day was the beginning of life returning to normal. My father, who remained British to the core, took us all to the movies to see the newsreel of the non-stop celebrations in London. The end of the war in Europe was frosting on the cake for my 10th grade year in Florida. I was looking forward to the years ahead in sunny Florida. But it didn't happen. Shortly after school let out for the summer, we moved back to New York, this time for good. A very normal girl. By now you know the drill. The new school on the Upper West Side was called Birchwaven, founded by two proper ladies named, surprise, Miss Birch and Miss Wathen. There were new friends, much easier this time, and a new penthouse to live in, the biggest and grandest so far. In the post-war euphoria, the Latin Quarter was the hottest nightclub in New York. Returning servicemen and tourists flocked to my father's lavish shows, making the club second only to Radio City Music Hall as a tourist destination. In the city that never sleeps, neither did the Latin Quarter. It was open 365 days a year, closing for just 2 days in 1945, to honor the death of President Franklin Roosevelt. All the biggest stars were now playing there. Milton Berle now started his routine. I knew Lou Walters before he could speak Latin and didn't have a quarter. The Palm Island Latin Quarter also reopened after the war to capacity audiences. America was in the mood to celebrate, and Miami Beach was booming. More and more hotels were springing up all over Miami Beach, filled not only with war-starved sun-worshippers from the north, but with former servicemen who had trained there. Dressed in Hawaiian shirts now instead of khaki, they were returning by the thousands to celebrate with their families, and they all went to the Latin Quarter. No reason, then, not to have one of the best possible apartments in all of New York. It was a penthouse in the 60s on Central Park West. The only apartment on the floor, it was surrounded on all four sides by huge terraces planted with flowers and small trees. My parents' bedroom overlooked the park, as did Jackie's. Mine did not, but it had another little room attached to it where other families' nannies had probably slept. So essentially, I had my own suite. The rest of the apartment was vast. There was an enormous wood-paneled living room, a music room with a piano nobody played, a library, a dining room, a huge kitchen with a butler's pantry, four bedrooms and up a short flight of stairs, a playroom with a bar and its own kitchen and bath, which we never used. One of our butlers did, though. He turned out to be an alcoholic, and we found all his bottles stashed up there. The apartment may have belonged previously to the Hearsts, the billionaire publishing family. When later, my cousin Selig visited the Hearst Castle in San Simeon, California, he was struck by the familiar paneling and was told by a guard that it had come from the Hearsts' penthouse in New York. In any case, there we were, in our own castle in New York, with our own treasures. My father filled the library shelves with his growing collection of first editions, the same books that are now in my own library. My mother, who had decorated all our previous homes herself, really went to town on this one. She bought red leather couches and chairs for the library, but the pièce de résistance was the living room. Here my mother chose a combination of pale yellow and lavender brocade for the couches and chairs, lots of pillows and tassels. The whole thing looked like a huge Easter egg. Mother hired a couple to cook and care for all our needs, but she still worried about our financial future. She'd gone from rags to riches to rags before with my father. Well, maybe not rags. More like going to cloth coats from fur. So I'm not sure she really trusted or enjoyed this newfound good fortune. I shared her unease. We both recognized my father's extravagant lifestyle and his equally extravagant approach to the shows he was producing. The costumes alone cost a small fortune. Many were designed by Erte, the famous Russian-born Paris designer and Art Deco painter who also designed the costumes for the Folies Bergères in Paris. The fabrics my father insisted on were top quality, silk, satin, velvet. No rayon for him and his girls. The sequins had to be sewn on by hand because they looked better than machine-stitched sequins. The underskirts of the can-can costumes had to have layers of individual ruffles, not cheaper all-in-one ruffles. Erte kept designing one more lavishly unique costume after another. His watercolor sketches for the costumes and the sets turned out to be works of art in themselves. I have collected many over the years. One reads on the back, "For the finale of the first act." Another reads, "This is for the girl with the red hair." The sketches now cover a whole wall in my apartment. The sheer volume of custom-made costumes from the Latin Quarters in New York and Palm Island led my father to open his own costume company in a warehouse in Manhattan. He made a sizable profit by renting the costumes to other shows and productions. He also used the expensive costumes to outfit the Latin Quarter touring companies he now began to launch. There were more and more showgirls to deck out in Erte's unique costumes. There were 36 young women in the chorus line, more than any Broadway musical today. Once or twice a year, my father went to Europe and came back with new chorus girls and dancers, sometimes more than a dozen at a time. The girls' pay in post-war Europe was a pittance compared to the $75 a week my father was willing to pay them. The most prized were the can-can dancers he brought back from the Lido nightclub in Paris. The Parisians not only did splits, but defied gravity and anatomy by jumping high in the air and landing in the splits. My father's American can-can dancers were somewhat intimidated by the French, but the Latin Quarter audiences loved them.